And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hey, everybody. In Los Angeles, this is Phil Lernis, one day away from big eye surgery, and in D-Town, it's the Motor City Madman, Dean Haglund, who seems to be battling a heat wave. Tell me about this, Dean.
Well, yes, presently in my studio, I have the air conditioning set at 83, and it kicks on every 2 minutes just to stay at 83. Now, this is also a condition of not just being a heat wave here in Michigan, but the very poor insulation. I perhaps remember coming here in the first few months of December and being in here with a full sweater and slippers because there's no insulation. So this is the price you pay.
Well, no, you. I do remember this. You spoke about this on the show, that you had, the heater had to be running full bore, like 24 hours a day, to maintain a 60-degree temperature?
60 degrees, yeah. Yeah. And now the air conditioner is almost running full bore just to stay at 83.
Now, so, I don't want to get into a discussion of climate change. Who am I joking? Of course I do. But I think you and I have spoken about this before. But when I, years back now, a handful of years, but probably this decade, maybe the end of last decade, but I took a tour of some of those homes, those really interesting little homes that are seem to be dangerously lining, for example, Laurel Canyon and the other and the other canyon roads that go up over Hollywood into the valley. But I'm talking about on the Hollywood side of the hill, right? And these homes were all built 1920s, right? When Hollywood first starts to expand.
Below. Yes,
and first, them being built right on the road, which, like I said, really does seem dangerous. I mean, seriously, if for people who haven't been here, it's truly you're stepping outside, and when you open your front door of your house, you'd better look both ways when you open the front door, because they're on curves, they're on turns. Somebody jumps a curb, they are right into your front door, and.
Right.
No sidewalks, no setbacks, anything like this. And so, of course, built at a time when carriage trade was really the main conveyance up to those homes, not cars, not automobiles. And if they were automobiles, they're automobiles, not speeding through there to get to the valley. They're going relatively slow, and that's their destination, is probably that, that house or a neighbor's house. So a different era. But the other thing that struck me was, of course, the noise. I don't know how they deal with the noise of the traffic being so close. And you can hear it because a lot of these homes lack any insulation whatsoever. Or no.
Yeah.
And yet others, older ones, have great insulation. That was the thing that really struck me going back to the 20s, was why do these homes have such great insulation? And then you read about it, and in the 1920s, winter was really cold often in
yeah,
LA.
Right.
So
that's weird. And often the insulation, I know we took apart I was renting a house built in 24, I guess, and there was some water damage. And when we took part of the wall out in between the lattice work, there was horsehair insulation, if you can imagine, just randomly stacked in there, which also provided excellent sound insulation because it was a duplex and we never heard our neighbors. So
fascinating.
I know you would never go back to that technology, I bet.
Well, I mean, maybe that's what we can. I don't know. Turn the lemons of the 30 horse deaths at Santa Anita Racetrack during the last season into lemonade. Look, we've got insulation. Okay, and yet I'm beating a dead horse. So the other thing that I just
that's
read about
terrible.
The other thing I just read about today was this hailstorm in Guadalajara.
No, I missed this.
Oh, what's my God. So Guadalajara in sunny Mexico, don't you know? This is a resort area where people often vacay during winter months, right? Because it's always so gorgeous in Guadalajara. they are buried in 5 feet of ice.
What?
Yeah. It's July. They are buried in 5 feet of ice after a massive hailstorm hit following an 83-degree day yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's some day after tomorrow Roland Emmerich shit right there.
It kind of is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who would have guessed that movie, of all movies, was the preeminent fourth
Well,
fourth
you know,
teller,
it did, and it wasn't, because it got something massively wrong, because it did talk about these superstorms that would bring sudden death, and that seemed sort of ridiculous, except, hello, the polar vortex that y'all lived through. I mean, that actually literally did cause deaths. Not instantaneous, but, you know, whether it's instantaneous or prolonged, I don't know which one you prefer. But the point is that the weather was literally killing people. That part, not such a big stretch. In the movie, though, Day After Tomorrow, if I remember correctly, the objective was get as far south as you can. Head towards equatorial climes, because that's how you can survive the oncoming climate change apocalypse. What we actually realize scientifically is no, and as Guadalajara just learned, no. In fact, the areas around the world that will be the least affected are certain northern climes that have an enclosed climate all to themselves. In this country, as I've said before, you're talking about the western half of the state of Vermont, for example, will be almost unaffected by climate change. You have the Puget Sound area in Washington State.
Yeah.
So, you know, for those of you who've always poo-pooed that I come from that part of the country, how does Puget Sound to you now? Okay, so, hey, I'm going in for surgery tomorrow, Dean Haglund.
Oh, yeah. How's that? Hey, how about that?
I thought last week was gonna, I'm really scared. I'm not gonna lie to you. I'm scared. I was right? up late last night, kind of frightened about it. And that wasn't, no, my cat, slept, fine. See what I just did there? Or were you speaking to Loki just now? But anyway, I thought I was going to be blissfully free from appointments last week. And kind of at the 11th hour, my surgeon said, come on in for more measurements. Let's try to get this. And I thought they had gotten pretty close the week before. And again, for anybody who's joining us lately, I've got this very rare form of cataracts. And the location of them made it very difficult to find them, but the density of them makes it almost impossible to accurately measure my lens, and therefore to build a replacement lens.
Wow.
You're talking about, I forget exactly, I'm making up this, but I do know that a 1 millimeter difference, you know, being off 1 millimeter on the size of the lens is, you know, like a factor of 4.5 on your prescription settings for your eyes. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge deal. Some of these readings that they'll get, like back-to-back readings, will be off by half a millimeter because of, again, the density of these cataracts. And so they brought me in for more readings. And anyway, it concluded with, and I have great faith in my surgeon. She seems spectacular. It concluded with her saying, I'm just going to have to work my magic.
That's what you want to hear. You know, I'm just going to wing it on the table and I'll just work my magic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, one assumes.
It was like how back in the 1980s when you would fly Delta and it was always a little concerning that you would see the pilots taking out that optional extra insurance that you could get with the flight.
And hearing them say, I'm going to work my magic.
So that's tomorrow. So,
tomorrow. Fantastic. So the day after Canada Day, happy Canada Day, by the way,
you
go under, and then how long are you in the hospital for?
Now, I don't know if I'm under. I mean, that's the other thing is I think you have to remain, what I'm praying to God is it's twilight. Like when I had, work done on my stomach and my esophagus a couple decades ago, I think I'm under. I come out of it thinking I was under, but I was in twilight so that I could respond. Because think about it. They can't really have you pass out when they're working on your eyes. And
I guess not.
And the other thing is that she's going to do more testing while performing the surgery to try to get the measurements as exact as possible. So I think they need me to respond. But I pray to God that it's not just a thing where it's anesthetic and I can't feel it, because I don't want to see someone come in my eyeball with a scalpel.
Yeah. Well, that would be freaky. That would be that Jean Cocteau movie all over again, wouldn't it?
Is it Cocteau? No, you're talking about Un Chien Andalou, the Louis Buñuel film.
Oh, yeah, Buñuel. That's right.
Yeah.
The image that I can never see because even watching the stills of it gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah, because you can't unsee it. That's the problem. Yeah, and that's now, how I feel, just it coming at me.
Are they going to use high-tech laser scalpels and shit like that? Isn't this precision? Aren't you being assisted by the Da Vinci 4000?
No.
Computer-aided software?
No, that's not covered by insurance, man. It's not.
It's about taking out the jitters of the surgeon's hand so that the robotic arm...
It's thousands of dollars more expensive, and it's not covered.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought it was just an assisting tool for the doctors.
It is, but... here's a news flash for you.
I've been in Australia too long.
Economy is based entirely on making money off sick people. Remember that? Remember that? Remember all the conversations we've had about that? Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Remember when we wrote the script Illumination and you had come up with astonishing statistics about the percentage of our workforce that's employed in just cancer care itself? And how you cure a major disease in this country would become a third world country overnight because our economy would collapse. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. In fact, the only reason that the surgery itself is covered by insurance, right? Because vision care is not, unless you pay for it optionally as extra, right? But, you go into an eye doctor and getting your prescriptions and things like that, that's not covered to a degree, except as an optional. But just baseline insurance pays for cataract surgery because without it, you can't be a functioning tax-paying citizen.
Right.
You can't hold down a job without it. But you can hold down jobs with blurry vision. That's the good news. All right. Hey, speaking about all this, what would be a better time than to open up the Chilpack morgue and discuss some celebrity deaths?
Celebrity deaths.
I want to talk about four. The first of these, Dean, is a good friend to the show, Robert Friend. Yeah, he was never a friend to the show. But Robert Friend died, Dean. And this is two ongoing conversations we've had through the years in one. As we've been saying a lot lately, as we've become more and more aware that these are our final days with our World War II heroes, quite frankly.
Right.
And the people that chronicled their exploits. Well, Robert Friend was one of the last surviving Tuskegee Airmen.
Oh.
Right? And this is the group of African-American pilots who flew the most dangerous of missions during World War II. In fact, they often were tasked with defending the Flying Fortress. Friend himself flew 142 missions during World War II as a member of the Tuskegee fighter pilots. And in fact, he tells one great story where he was facing mechanical difficulties and bad weather, and so had to bail out and parachute down in the mountains of Italy, enemy territory, right behind enemy lines. And he hit the side of the mountain, slid down to the ground, and no sooner than he was relieved to have survived than he sees a woman running at him with a big knife in her hand.
Jeez.
It was
not calling him for dinner, I bet.
No, but also not interested in him at all. It was an act of wartime desperation, and she simply was desperate for the silk in the parachutes.
Oh my God! Wow,
isn't that amazing? That's, so she left him alone and just cut him free from his chutes and kept the chutes. he died at the age of 99. So this again is it's amazing that any of these heroes were still with us. I want to talk about something else about him. He continued to serve. He became operations officer for both the Korean and Vietnam Wars.
Wow.
From 1958 until 1963, he was the director of a United States Air Force program known as Project Blue Book.
Oh, yeah. Known throughout the conspiracy worlds.
So he was the director of the initiative that investigated UFO sightings. I read at one point he investigated 12,000 sightings.
Amazing.
He was a big advocate for the formation on two different occasions. He advocated strongly for the formation of a independent, maybe not civilian investigation body, but an investigation body with civilian oversight into these matters. So Robert Friend, what a fascinating life that man led.
Yeah. And I guess now the U.S. Navy has changed their rules about reporting UFOs and are releasing all this footage now. So I guess that's a testament to his legacy then.
Well, as Tucker said in our movie, The Truth Is Out There, right? Pilots, they saw things, right?
Yeah.
So many of them. And that goes on in certainly recent decades. O'Hare, right? O'Hare Airport and the sightings. So anyway, there's a lot about that. It's some of the most interesting stuff in our documentary, The Truth Is Out There. So at 91 years of age, novelist Judith Krantz has died.
What? You're kidding.
So even you know the name Judith Krantz.
How can you not go by any airport bookstore and see her name boldly printed on half the books in there?
Yes. Wildly popular, best-selling romance novelist. I know the name of some of the books, even though, of course, never have read a page of them. But Judith Krantz's Scruples is kind of was a ubiquitous title for many years. That was her debut novel. But get this, her debut novel in 1978, Dean.
Good Lord.
So
wow.
41 years ago, she dies at 91. So here's another person who will be remembered as a thing, as an occupation.
Right.
And yet she didn't come to it until she was past 50 years of age.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Think of that.
10 novels.
So there's still hope for you.
I can write a romance novel, a sex and shopping novel, as they were known. Beach Reads. Anyway, she, and of course, one of the reasons that I know about her, and I'm sure you know as well, is that so many of these books were made into like TV miniseries. It was also the age of the television miniseries. So it was perfect for her, right? It was the perfect storm. Right. So you had Judith Krantz's Secrets, right?
Oh,
which
yes.
is such a big one. Paperback rights to her 1980 sophomore effort, Princess Daisy, sold for a record-breaking at that time, $3.2 million. Those were the paperback rights to her second novel. That's how popular a chord she struck.
Wow.
She, you know, as they said, a late bloomer, never planned to become a novelist. She famously said she learned her lesson about writing fiction after her Wellesley College creative writing professor gave her a B for her atrocious spelling. Why? I don't really quite understand that, but that I don't understand her appeal either. So there you go. she wrote in her early career articles as a freelancer for magazines, including Ladies' Home Journal, McCall's, Cosmopolitan, certainly, if nothing else, learned about what her audience would be.
Right. Right. She knew her. She wrote specifically to an audience that, you know, didn't include me, but that's fine. I support her anyway. Then salute her.
And again, I find it so inspiring. And,
right?
In fact, I ought to be revealing something that I'm going to save until I have eyesight and we can get into what we're reading. I've got a very exciting bit of news about something I will be reading once I can read again and once the publication date takes place. All right.
What?
Hey, Dr. John. This happened a couple weeks ago, but Dr. John, this made me really sad. Dr. John was a legendary New Orleans singer and musician. He died at 77. He was known a lot of people for his lively voodoo-themed stage shows, where he took on the persona of the Night Tripper.
Wow.
Born Malcolm Rebenack, Dr. John combined blues, jazz, rock, pop, and boogie-woogie and created really his own unique musical style, and it was indelible and unmistakable. You never heard Dr. John's stuff and thought it was anybody else.
Right. I don't think I actually could pick Dr. John out of a lineup of songs, but I'll take your word for it.
I think you would. I mean, it's not that you could necessarily name it, but if you've heard his stuff, you wouldn't think it was anybody else. That's what I'm saying. You wouldn't guess. You wouldn't guess incorrectly. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2011. Introduced into that ceremony by singer John Legend. His best known song is his 1973 top 20 hit, which I think you know, Dean. Right place, wrong time.
Oh yeah, Okay. Oh, that's him.
Yeah. He was a guitarist. He was a pianist as well as a singer. And he was an in-demand session player who recorded with many artists and always, again, contributed something that you if again, if you knew his work, you would go to the liner notes and go, I could swear Dr. John's on this track. He was never an anonymous session musician, let's say. The artists that would call upon him ranged from Van Morrison, which makes a lot of sense, to Frank Zappa.
Wow.
He also toured with Ringo Starr's All-Star Band.
Fun.
And he's featured playing with the band in The Last Waltz.
Oh, the Rolling Stones documentary.
No, the band.
Oh, yeah, the band. That's right.
Which I said, I didn't mean little b, I meant capital B, the band.
Oh, yeah. I thought I was supposed to guess the band. The band.
All right. Dead at 96, Dean Hackland, is Gianfranco Corsi Zeffirelli, better known as Franco Zeffirelli.
Oh, the director of that Romeo Juliet 1968 version that we watched in high school almost every English class.
That Romeo and Juliet. Look, he was an Italian director and producer of operas as well as films and television. He was more than that, though. He served as a senator in Italy from 1994 till 2001 for the Italian center-right Forza Italia party. His operatic designs and productions have become worldwide classics. He was known for 1968 Romeo and Juliet. He received an Academy Award nomination for that. Though, for my money, I would remember him a little more fondly for the previous year's version of The Taming of the Shrew with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. That is big fun, that movie. And I would argue probably the best known adaptation of that particular play.
It's been a while since I've seen that, actually.
In the late 70s, here we were talking about miniseries with Judith Kranz. And it's so amazing. There are so many generations that don't know the miniseries. And what a big deal that was on television.
I know.
This was what you dropped during sweeps months because miniseries would get the biggest ratings.
Well, and technically, this is what Netflix does now, right?
Of course.
So.
Yeah. Anyway, his 1977 miniseries, Jesus of Nazareth, won both national and international acclaim and is still frequently shown as day-long marathons on Christmas and Easter in many countries.
Wow.
So in addition to being a senator in Italy, he won an award called the Grand Ufficiale Omri, O-M-R-I, of the Italian Republic since 1977. So I guess that's a big, big deal. What I do know is it's a big deal that in 2004, he received a British knighthood.
He did?
Yeah.
Sir Franco Zeffirelli?
Exactly. Yes. A knight of the British Empire.
How about that?
So, how about it, indeed? all right.
All right.
So, Franco Zeffirelli, and we'll close up the Chilpack Morgue.
Uh-huh.
Now, last week, we were talking a bit about, over the last couple weeks, about the failure of some of these big box office franchises and what the studios that hope to launch franchises can learn from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And in the way that they launched their universe, they launched these with a terrific origin stories and then sequels that continue to explore the character, right?
Right.
Indeed, it is their standalone movies, far more than their Avengers juggernauts, that are the ones that actually resonate culturally, right?
Right.
You know, Black Panther last year, right? I mean, was actually an important movie for large swaths of population. And and we also pointed out how, hopeful studios wanting to make franchises or maintain franchises could learn a lot from the early James Bond films, from the recent John Wick franchise. But what I'm worried about is that there's a two-prong box office failure right now. It's not just that the franchises.
Okay.
And
with part two.
And even, you know, but that we've got some great counter-programming. We've got some great female-driven comedies. And they're female-driven, which we salute. We think that's serving an audience. They're comedies, which we salute, which we think is serving an audience. And they're good, which we salute and think is serving an audience. And they're finding no box office success at all. The two most recent examples of this are Late Night, starring Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling. And, of course, Booksmart, which we spoke about last month.
Yeah.
Utterly failing. And
nobody's going to these things.
Other than the base target audience, right? Teen girls went to Booksmart. But that's not enough. Even if it's modestly budgeted, right? $10 million total take was not enough for that movie. And so the question is, I think it comes back to marketing, right? How do you let people know about these films? There's so much product. There's so much product everywhere. How can you market these films without bankrupting yourselves, without, you know, the marketing costing so much that there's no way the film can ever turn a profit?
Right.
And how do you market effectively to let people know that this might be for you rather than just for the target audience? It's an interesting question that almost mirrors politics right now, which is the question of, are you interested in expanding your base? Or are you just going to appeal to your base? Because we know that getting the base to turn out is so often the difference in elections.
Right. You don't have to appeal to the largest. Oddly, the way the gerrymandering and college, electoral college exists, if you appeal to your base, you're ahead of the game if there's a low voter turnout.
Yeah. I mean, you just kind of you nailed both the macro and the micro, right? On local districts, gerrymandering, and on the massive scale of the electoral college. So with movies, right, how does it matter? Well, I would argue that clearly for these movies, if you're going to make these movies, and we hope people do because they're good, they're funny. We want good, funny comedies. We want good, funny comedies that are female driven. So how can we let people know about them? That's a conversation that I think we would be well advised to start to wrestle with. What are marketing ideas? Interestingly enough, 12 years ago this week, on this very podcast, back when it was known as From the Heart of Hollywood, we were discussing very much the same topic, but where independent films were concerned. How can you market and distribute independent films differently, and what's the responsibility of the independent filmmakers themselves to know how to market a film and to tie, if at all possible, that marketing into the making of the movie itself?
Right, that you're thinking now not just the first half, how I'm gathering a crew and filming this script, but also part two, how am I going to get it out there, get it in the right hands, which festivals, all of that sort of thing.
So I think this is something that we'll wrestle with, unless you have any obvious answers. If you can solve the problem right now, please drop it on the table.
Well, I'm all up for this subscriber Patreon type model where you directly access one by one the people that are into your product. And then you're not casting a wide net hoping to find some lone wanderer who maybe doesn't know what he likes or doesn't like, or he or she isn't into fan groups and websites that are already existing, but just sort of wondering what they should watch. That doesn't really happen anymore. People now are really focused on stuff they love, and your ability to get into that stream of stuff they love with making something that is in the wheelhouse of stuff they love is kind of the model now, I think. So,
okay, but how do you let them know about it? And because they still need to find out about it.
Right.
And how do you get them into the theater? Because it's about the future of movies as cinema going. That's what we're trying to solve here.
Yes.
Not how can everyone have their own fucking internet channel dedicated to them, implanted in a chip on their brain. How does communal movie going continue to work? Because there are enough examples over the last couple of years of people want to go to the movies. So how do you get them there? What is the – and part of it, of course, is the economics need to shift in some ways. But so think further about this Patreon model, and we'll revisit in this conversation next week. Start to think in terms of how that can apply to the again, from the smaller to the larger. And, you know, and maybe it involves reaching out and getting them involved with the making of a movie earlier. So we will continue this discussion next week. Now, 12 years ago, it wasn't just the marketing of independent films that we were interested in, but directly the marketing of a particular entry in the torture porn subgenre of horror films.
Yes. Now, I don't know if that subgenre still exists. I have been following the horror film.
Fascinating. That's one of the reasons that I chose this clip as our historic clip of what we were talking about 12 years ago so that we could discuss it on the other side.
I don't know how we veered off so much from marketing again. We got a great email from one of our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Alyssa?
Alyssa in Ventura County?
Who talked about seeing, Captivity.
Oh,
seeing
yes.
the trailer for Captivity. And, of course, this is one of my cause celebs.
Cause celebs. Down with Captivity.
And Captivity, which lost its release date twice due to one of the most
offensive
and irresponsible advertising campaigns ever launched.
You know it's bad when Eli Roth is trashing it.
Yes.
He was trashing Captivity's
ad campaign. And now they have just the absolutely disgusting gall to bill this as the film they didn't want you to see. And now they're trying to use what... And again, those of us that attacked Captivity, and I was involved in that.
Yes, you were.
I was not attacking the movie.
No.
I had not seen the movie. Again, as
it
I said...
It might have been good.
It might have been good. It was directed by Roland Jaffe, who did The Killing Fields, one of the most powerful cinematic
anti-war.
Expressions of anti-violence ever put on celluloid. So as far as I know, it could have been the Citizen Kane of torture porn movies. However, the advertising campaign was absolutely irresponsible.
Yeah.
And
for those who don't remember, it was billboards.
Billboards
put up
in New York and Los Angeles, all within clear view of elementary schools.
Mm-hmm. With four different panels. And it was like bondage and death. I forget what the four.
Well, each one was, different. It was like abduction, torture, something murder.
Right, it actually said torture and murder.
Yeah, murder. And this was entertainment, and the images were absolutely grisly.
And they were almost like 1950s pulp paintings of tortured women. They were like enhanced Photoshop photos of Elizabeth Cuthbert.
And so it was terrible, and we really attacked the ad campaign, and sure enough, it worked in a sense. On the other hand, as I said back then, they're going to market this as the film they wouldn't want you to see.
You
see,
did say that.
Censorship.
Right.
If you're against censorship, come see this movie.
Right.
here we are back in 2019, and Dean, I think the first thing we should talk about is how delightful an experience it is to hear one of us in one ear and the other in the other ear.
I believe that's when I was mixing the show, and somehow I would just plug in our microphones and just stick us on one channel each, and not realizing that not mixing it down made us sound very trippy.
And when the music would come in at the beginning of the show and it would be in both, it was really something. So, so an interesting time capsule piece to early podcasting. The issue of torture porn. Should we get that taken care of first?
Yes. The little research that I've done. Torture porn, the subgenre of horror films, replacing the splatter movies of terror, nudity, sadism, often women being victimized, and kind of a big box office moneymakers like Saw, the Saw series, and Hostel, and all of those. But by 2009, if I'm not mistaken, it's mostly replaced by remakes of the 80s horror movies like My Bloody Valentine, Dawn of the Dead.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And Friday the 13th.
That's the thing, is it's not a replacement for splatter films, but it was a subgenre. It became this subgenre of splatter films. And you're right, it was hugely successful, but it was hugely successful for less than a decade.
Right.
And as is often the case, when something is easily imitated, I feel, then it dies out quickly. Now, am I a fan of torture porn? Absolutely not, okay? And those people who get pissed off to this day about how derisive a term it is, okay, fine. But what we're calling it that because that's what it was called. But I'm going to equate it to disco. Disco could not have been more popular, and yet rapidly it became open season on disco. And I maintain that the reason for that sudden explosion of popularity followed by the sudden backlash of hostility was because the sound itself was so easily replicated that it became something you hated.
Right.
Whereas many of the early pioneering and most popular exponents of disco were really talented singers and musicians who I maintain would have become popular no matter when they came of age. But because they gained that popularity in a genre that could be easily replicated, that's why they tended to get dusted away with the trash heap of later disco entries. So with torture porn, it suddenly shifts. And I've got to believe that the out-and-out furor over the movie we discussed, Captivity, was maybe a tipping point because it's 2007.
Yes.
There would still be later Saw entries, but those are sequels in a franchise at that point.
And that was a lot back then also of going straight to DVD. Remember hearing that phrase back in the day?
Yeah. I don't know of any following Captivity original torture porn films that did perform successfully at the box office. And they had been huge box office successes prior to that. So that's interesting. Here we are talking about something 12 years ago that no longer even exists. The quote that I found that I thought was great, because remember, in 2007, Phil Lernis was someone who would have told you, you know what, I don't like horror films. I
think,
right? I was not a proponent, not a fan. Boy, how that has changed.
I know.
But one of the reasons is because of something that I think is illustrated in a George Romero quote. When the Eli Roths of the world, the Stephen Kings of the world were defending torture porn movies, or whatever you wanted to call them if you were defending them, as movies that pushed the envelope, that were disturbing. George Romero said, what disturbs me is that they utterly lack metaphor.
Right. Right.
And that's where horror can especially not only thrive, but leave a lasting cultural imprint is in the metaphor. When you tap into our nightmares and convey through those stories metaphor that speaks to how we live in our daily lives, you have a recipe for something that's really going to stand the test of time.
Right? I mean, that's what Get Out is in our generation, current generation. Is a metaphor for Black Lives Matter.
Well, I mean, Get Out. It Follows. Let the Right One In. On and on and on. I mean, I just think, a few years ago, I don't think this is the case anymore, but you remember earlier parts of this decade, I was saying to you, dear God, if it weren't for horror films, I would think that cinema had completely lost its soul. Horror films were suddenly saving the soul of cinema.
Well, probably because everybody read that George Romero quote and went, oh, metaphor, not just splatter and blood and guts and without any step into some sort of sociological debate or thought, but actually tie that and turn that around. And now you're seeing that.
So another aspect of what we spoke about that I wanted to visit here was the outrage, justifiable outrage, and I was a major exponent of that outrage, the billboard campaign,
yes,
advertising captivity that was put up by schools, elementary schools in major cities. And
now this was the idea that the marketing, I think your quote directly was, I haven't seen the film. I don't know if the film is good or bad. This is strictly about the marketing and the inappropriateness of the marketing.
On several levels, right? Images, right. Haunting, nightmare-inducing images, traumatic, trauma, not nightmare, trauma-inducing images, put up intentionally for kids to see them, kids who were many years from removed from being old enough to even see the movie.
Right.
And it smacked me maybe then, but certainly now, of the most cynical kind of opportunism, which is we are trying to generate a controversy so that we can get the label, the movie they don't want you to see, as a way of marketing a movie that we know turns out to be a piece of shit. And I'm not saying that it's a piece of shit because it was of the genre it was. I'm saying that once it came out and the reviews were out of the movie that would be nominated for so many Golden Razzie Awards as the worst film of the year, including Worst Actress and Worst Director, they knew they had a terrible movie on their hands.
Right.
So what if we generate controversy?
And did that generate, I mean, so you think specifically they made a completely outlandish billboard thing, putting it in inappropriate places specifically to generate controversy to put lipstick on a pig?
Well, let me answer your question with a question to you.
Okay.
If they do that intentionally to cravenly try to generate controversy so that some people will want to see it or will be motivated to see it because it's either become controversial or because it's become a cause célèbre, a freedom of speech and expression issue. If they've intentionally done that to cover up, or as you say, to put lipstick on a pig.
Right.
Versus putting up advertising like this, their main advertising thrust being in front of schoolyards in this country, not knowing what that problem was, which is worse.
Well, that's true, right? Yeah, that if you're blind to it. But this is the thing. We've never seen that marketing again. And now in the age of Me Too and we are much more aware of that kind of cultural blowback. I gotta think we learned a lesson from that.
But this is what I want to zero in on for a second. What was the last billboard advertising campaign you were aware of?
The Room. That billboard stayed up on La Cienega for years.
But I mean, is that even a thing? Is billboard advertising even
a thing for movies now? Or no, because, you know, the only billboard we see is for the casino in Windsor, the live stage shows like Steve Martin and, you know, the Steve Martin show.
There was a wonderful, right, Judy Holliday comedy, It Should Happen to You, one of the early Jack Lemmon vehicles, where she literally becomes famous through taking out billboards and putting herself up on them.
Right, Angeline.
That's where Angeline got the idea. And but would that work now?
No. Well, would it work now? I mean, there's outliers that says billboard advertising works, right? The three billboards of whatchamacallit was a movie.
Set a long time ago, yeah.
set a long time ago. There was the, yeah, you're right. I don't even think billboards are a functioning way of marketing anymore.
I mean, one of the ways to look into it is, are the likes of Banksy still marking up billboards? Because if he's not, well, then we know that billboard advertising isn't even a thing anymore.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, right.
So, jeez, okay. Fascinating,
the
right?
The fact that we were asking, the fact that I'm drawing a blank says that, yeah, it's no longer a thing.
So, all right. Well, there you go. That was our clip from 12 years ago. I hope, I found that really interesting. I found it both, yeah. I don't know, both uplifting and depressing in the same time. How much things can change and how much things can stay the same.
Yeah. That's what happens when you listen to our show.
All right. Hey, I saw a couple of movies that I want to get your feedback on here.
Because you were blind and you couldn't see what was going on. You just heard it.
I can do pretty well with well-restored black and white films right now, actually.
Oh, okay.
But because, you know, they're grayscales, they're levels of gray. poorly restored black and white films are terrible because they just are white to me, which is not my critical evaluation of Laurel and Hardy movies, though they are very they are very white. We talked about Laurel and Hardy apropos of that Steve Coogan, John C. Reilly vehicle,
right
at Christmas time. And, you know, and I'm really, I remember seeing Laurel and Hardy shorts when I was a kid, but really uneducated when it came to their features. And I finally watched Sons of the Desert.
Oh, right.
From William Sider, 1933, yeah. Considered maybe their best film?
Maybe their best film. And, of course, it is also the name of the global fan club of Laurel and Hardy. You're known as the Sons of the Desert.
Now, they are undeniably funny and undeniably gifted performers with undeniable, unassailable chemistry with each other.
Right.
I don't have to play the game of, oh, in context of the times, yeah, this is funny. I don't have to intellectualize it.
Right.
And as we know with the Marx Brothers, as we know with Preston Sturgis or in silent comedies, Keaton and Lloyd and that crowd, and certainly, of course, Chaplin. You don't have to intellectually try to place yourself in context to find it funny. It still captivates you when it's well done. So that's how I feel about Laurel and Hardy. They are funny. And
right.
no one under a certain age knows who they are, and I'm convinced nobody under a certain age knows who they are because I'm beginning to think their movies weren't good.
What?
I don't think Sons of the Desert is a good movie. Dear God. I think it's a good setup. It's a good first 20, 30 minutes, and then it's like, fuck me. They don't give a shit about telling a story or having anything make sense. Their setups, you know what it reminds me of is throwaway sitcoms of the 1950s.
Gosh. Well, there is a good point. I mean, the setup is they're trying to fake an illness so they can go to their wild convention, the Sons of the Desert,
and great setup. And how they get out of town, great. And then they go there, and then it's like, oh, okay, what do we do now? Well, they got to get in trouble about this. How will they get in trouble?
The boat sinks.
Well, not only the boat sinks. Oh, I know. How about this member of the fraternal lodge that they meet in Chicago just happens to be the long-lost brother of one of their wives who decides to call them. I mean, what in the world?
Okay.
It's so lazy. And it was very odd. I want to talk about the films of Krzysztof Kieslowski. I've been wanting to do this for a couple of different reasons. But his final movie was Red, from the Three Colors trilogy. And it's so funny that I rewatched that the same week that I watched this because they both pivot on a plot point of a liner going down. The seagoing vessel going down, and only a handful of people survive. And sure, that's funny.
Well, as a device to go, oh my God, now the ship's gone down. We have to explain why we weren't on that ship.
I guess in 1933, in the height of the Depression, sure, let's sink an ocean liner. That'll be funny.
Okay, so it's you're saying don't use the plane crash. How come you weren't on that plane? You said you were flying to Hawaii. Plane crash scenario.
Yeah, this is my thought. Was if this is the best that they've got, I understand why no young people know who they are. What?
Well, but it's not the best they got. Their shorts are amazing.
Okay.
The movers, the big steps, the big stairs.
So then the question becomes what form, like I know these because I would literally go to the local pizza parlor when I was a kid and they would show Laurel and Hardy shorts.
Absolutely. And I went to a marijuana bar in Utrecht, the Netherlands, and they were showing Laurel and Hardy movies to all the kids from around the globe who were high as kites.
So how are younger generations going to find that now in this day and age and be interested in it?
I guess legalized marijuana is the way forward, unfortunately. Is that what I'm suggesting?
Or since the number one thing on Netflix is reruns of The Office, and they're losing The Office on Netflix, maybe you replace them with Laurel and Hardy shorts. I don't know. So off the top of your head, is there a Laurel and Hardy feature that you would recommend?
Wow. Over the Sons of the Desert, I like the one where they're in the Foreign Legion. I forgot the name of that one. Okay, now you're making me go through my Laurel.
No, but see, but this is my. I'm not putting the pressure on you because. All right, Dean Haglund, what Marx Brothers movie would you recommend?
Well, Duck Soup. Okay. And then Night at the Opera. Yeah. Okay,
Dean Haglund, what Harold Lloyd movie would you recommend?
Well, Safety Last, and then followed by. Safety Last, yeah.
And then followed by Safety Last. That's my favorite double feature. But anyway, you see what I'm getting at here. My point is you have answers ready for those. You know what people should see, and they work for you. In addition to being ones of historical import, they work for you. And so if you have to struggle and go back and research and go, oh, yeah, that was pretty good, this is illustrating my point a little bit. I certainly want to see they did a Western. I know they did a Western. I want to see that. Right. So I'll keep watching these because, indeed, I'm quite fond, again, of them, of their performance.
Flying Deuces. Flying Deuces comes to you. Yeah. So, now you got me.
Now, speaking of the Marx Brothers, Edward... also, I gotta tell one last thing about this event, Sons of the Desert. I understand, so it's acclaimed as maybe their best. Therefore, the fan club is named for it. But if it was really thought to be that good, wouldn't you think that William Sider, the director of it, would be tasked with doing another one of their movies? And he never works with them again. He does go on to work with many of the other comedy greats, but it strikes me as odd that they wouldn't think, oh, maybe we should put him with it. That worked really well. But he does go on later to do, I think Room Service with the Marx Brothers, which is one of their lesser ones, obviously. But speaking of the Marx Brothers, I finally saw for the first time 1939's At the Circus.
Oh, right.
And
this is a sequel to Night at the Opera.
No.
Oh, no, A Day at the Races was the sequel. At the Circus comes after that.
Yeah, 1939. And they really are only doing these movies because, again, Chico keeps losing all his money in real life.
Yeah, he has a gambling problem.
But it's, again, it's funny. How could it not be? Groucho Marx plays a lawyer, J. Loophole Cheever, who's brought in to try to save this circus in financial straits. Some really fun supporting performers, including Eve Arden, who's really quite wonderful.
I know, right? Very young.
Not a bad movie. Like, the initial, Lily's reaction to it was, wow, this is really exhausting. This is not very good. But I was fascinated by it because I was going, yeah, but I don't understand. It's not like the Marx Brothers movies are usually exhausting. And they're working really hard.
Well, there's your key word.
But it's that. They cared. It's not that they didn't care. I think they did other movies where it was clear they were exhausted and didn't care, and it was just the payday. But here they cared.
Right.
But it as one critic said, it was perspiration without inspiration. And that really smacks of truth. And to then learn that the studio did not give them the opportunity to do, which you have long championed, their usual policy of, even when their shows weren't based on stage shows, they would take the material out into nightclub settings and they would rehearse and rehearse and rehearse the material
in front of a live audience.
On
stages. But by 1939, vaudeville stages were closing had closed already since the advent of sound. That's already 12 years into sound film. So you are lacking at that point the ability just to find enough stages, I would think, to even perform your show, to get a sense of what where the timing is, how it's playing across the entire nation, which is what they did.
So how important then is this fascinating alchemy when it comes to comedy, which is all the hours and hard work it takes to make something look effortless? Because they are working really hard to make this be a funny, entertaining movie. And of course, at times it is. But the effect of watching such hard, heavy lifting does become exhausting. And once you're exhausted, you're no longer laughing. That ineffable state of merriment is punctured, and a heaviness replaces it. And so in comedy, the effortlessness is everything, and effortlessness takes so much work and so much preparation. And they were denied the opportunity to put that kind of work and preparation in. And doesn't that explain to a degree why comedies, one reason why comedies get harder and harder and harder to make?
Absolutely. Because A, you inspired comedy. It's not that you go, oh, I got a great idea for comedy. You could have a great idea for comedy, write it down in a script, and then labor day after day filming this thing, trying to put it out, trying to get to set, you know, it's overheating, everybody's late, blah, 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 all the problems that come with production, then all that inspiration goes out the window. So it also has to be on the day on set that you are inspired, fresh, not beleaguered by whatever was going on in, I think it was Harpo's life at that point. There was some lawsuit, or I can't remember. Somebody had also, not just Chico's gambling habit, but one of the other Marx Brothers had a legal issue going on during the filming of that. And it shows, right, that they can't, some of the scenes aren't focused. Some of them, they're rehashing bits from their earlier stage days in that one. And yeah, it's tough. Comedy is tough, even when you've got chances.
And again, they're not going through the motions. It's not that. Which we will see in other movies of theirs.
Yes.
They care. Yeah. It's not a lack of caring. But this is the point, is the comedy is still really, really hard. And they, who made it so effervescent, it's important to appreciate, God, the constant hours, the years, the decades that went in to making it seem so effortless. All right. So much that we did not get to. I also finally, for the first time since film school, watched Hitchcock's Rope. And I want to talk about this.
Yes.
We are also, one of the reasons I watched Kieslowski's Colors trilogy again, there's many reasons why I did, but one of the reasons is because it was 25 years ago that Red, Kieslowski's final film, was surprisingly beat for the Palme d'Or at Cannes by Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. And I want to talk about how that was a watershed moment that ushered in a major course correction where art house cinema was concerned. And how, whether maybe 25 years on, we now have had another course correction that we'll be talking about, years hence. So I want to look at all those, and I want to look at all those because Tarantino's new movie is coming out this week. So what could be a better time? He is 25 years on from Pulp Fiction, saying that his next film will be his last film. And a lot of people don't want to take that seriously, don't believe in taking that seriously. Obviously, there have been many artists throughout history who say they're retiring, and they retire again and again and again. I'm looking at you, Sinatra.
I'm looking at you, Cher.
With Kieslowski, he said, this is going to be my last movie. And sure enough, it was. And even if he hadn't intended it to be, the fact that he would be dead 2 years later following heart surgery made sure that he was true to his word. So it just feels like this is the right time to have that that conversation, looking back to where art house cinema was 25 years ago, where it is now. And maybe we'll have time to talk about Rope. I want to follow up with you about this discussion of using the Patreon model as one for marketing your movies directly to audience.
Yeah.
And we have a lovely email from the venerable Agent Summer, who was kind enough to send the email in the largest font type she could so that I could read it. I don't want to read it now because we would be giving it short shrift. It's a really, her question is fascinating, and it's always delightful to hear from you, to hear from you as well, Dean Haglund.
Well, good luck on that surgery. Of course, relax some heavy breathing when you see this scalpel coming to your eyeball. That's all I'm saying. Oh my God. One bit of advice.
I mean, the good news is no matter how poorly it goes, there's at least one more surgery where that came from, because I got two eyes, don't you know?
And then you'll wear sunglasses from there on in.
Hey, the clip that you heard was from Chilpak Hollywood Hour number 9, July 2nd, 2007. I have made Chilpak Hollywood Hours 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 all available again at chillpackhollywood.com. The rebuild is going along in a slower fashion. Once I can see again, things will speed up dramatically. But episodes 6 through 10 are now available for listening pleasure if you want to hear the fuller range of the conversation regarding captivity, film marketing, and want to enjoy more of our two-channel mono audio podcasting. Until next week, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.